WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On October 6th, the White House announced that the president would be giving a major policy address on terrorism. All three cable news networks ran the speech in its entirety. When it turned out the president had nothing new to say about terrorism and the event was just another stump speech, a Slate article suggested that the networks had been snookered into giving the president an hour of free ad time. Burned.
Live and yet don't learn. Early Monday morning, the cable news anchors told us to stay tuned for a significant speech by the president on the war on terror. So we did, and this is what we heard.
The senator who claims the world is more dangerous since America started fighting the war on terror is the same senator who said that Ronald Reagan's policies of peace through strength actually made America less safe.
MSNBC ran the president's speech uninterrupted for 43 minutes. CNN showed 36 minutes, and Fox, 47 minutes. But equal time was the order of the day, at least on some cable channels.
I want to take you now live to Florida, where John Kerry now addressing another campaign rally.
MSNBC and CNN gave the Democratic nominee nearly equal time. Fair and balanced Fox switched him off after 9 minutes. But when it came to nuance, the president won hands down on all the channels. The media called his a major policy address, while Kerry, well, he was just campaigning.
Such are the advantages of incumbency. And if it works for the president, it works even better for politicians lower down the electoral food chain. Between the media and redistricting, challengers don't stand a chance, as WNYC's Bob Henley reports.
While the country deals with the tension of a potential presidential cliffhanger, incumbents in Congress, with very rare exceptions, are feeling pretty confident right now. And why not? Irrespective of party in 2002, over 90% of them got reelected, the highest percentage since 1954, backed by a more than 4-to-1 cash advantage over their Don Quixote-like opponents. In the second-floor walk-up campaign headquarters, there is not an empty folding chair. Back in May, New Jersey's 7th District Democratic challenger Steve Brozak was off to an ambitious start. He left active duty as a Marine Lieutenant Colonel, having served in Iraq. As a result of that deployment, Brozak, a Republican, decided to switch parties and run for Congress as a Democrat. Why? As it works out, to make locally the same kind of critique Senator Kerry was making nationally on the war in Iraq.
Here's the story. We went out there like a drunken gambler. This administration doubled up. They went out there and did it with too few people, without any planning, and they did it without any forethought to what would take place as far as the peace was concerned.
Just as Brozak, who has served in Haiti, Bosnia, and with the United Nations, aligns with the top of his ticket, his opponent, incumbent Congressman Mike Ferguson, make sure there is no daylight between himself and President Bush.
I have a very strong record of leadership in the Congress for the last 4 years of supporting our troops, supporting the families of our troops. They're showing incredible service and commitment and courage, and I certainly believe a political season is no time to be sending a mixed message to our troops.
Ferguson never served in the military. It's early evening in Summit, New Jersey, part of the 7th Congressional District. Yes, the presidential election is being billed as the most important in a generation, and perhaps the most expensive ever. As for the over 400 races for Congress, the People's House, few have a clue. Christopher Sue, an enthusiastic President Bush backer.
For Congress? I actually don't even know who's running at this point.
Voter Peter Ropke has followed the presidential race closely, but farther down the ballot remains something of a void.
Who are you going to pick for Congress?
Let's see, who is the congressman in my area? I think it's Forrester.
Where are you from?
I live in Hunterdon County, Clinton Township.
Or is it Ferguson?
Ferguson, you're right. It is Ferguson.
Who's Forrester? A New Jersey businessman who spent millions of his own money to run unsuccessfully for the Senate. These days, he's been jamming the airwaves with ads and using automated phone calls like this one to get CBS's Dan Rather fired over his botched report on President Bush's Air National Guard service.
This is Doug Forrester, calling to ask for your support in our fight to retire Dan Rather. He is a classic example of liberal media bias. His use of CBS to support his own political agenda has got to stop. We need your
help. When it comes to not being able to name their congressman, Sue and Robke are not alone. Surveys indicate two-thirds of Americans don't know who represents them. But in the New York market, they can't escape conservative businessman Forrester, who's not running for anything, yet has bought himself better name recognition than an incumbent member of Congress. Last time, hundreds of millions were spent to shape all the congressional races. Locally this time, thanks to six-figure backing from the pharmaceutical industry, Congressman Ferguson built up a $2.6 million war chest. He did get slammed with a $210,000 Federal Election Commission fine for improperly using money from a family trust. Even so, experts say he's got the race sewn up. Early on, challenger Brozak won a coveted shot to address a Democratic convention in Boston, but ultimately did not convince National Democratic strategists that his campaign was worth being one of the handful of races they're investing in. He's raised just over $600,000. But in this three-card Monty, where the House incumbents almost always win, the fix is in long before voters are poised to make their choice. Under the guise of satisfying the constitutional requirement of using the latest census figures to update House district boundaries, the process creates something else.
Good afternoon, Eagleton. Good afternoon.
Ingrid Reed with Rutgers University's Eagleton Institute of Politics.
After the 2000 census, when we had to check and see that the districts are balanced equally so that, you know, each district has exactly the same number of people in it, the two parties basically agreed that the division between seven Democratic districts and six Republican districts made sense. So the districts were shaped to be composed of basically Republican and Democratic voters that would assure that the incumbents would continue to serve easily.
Reed says that in addition to redistricting, a total lack of media coverage of the House races explains why, when it comes to voters in election time, it's like members of Congress have joined a kind of witness protection program.
Congressional races are basically invisible. Because it doesn't look like an incumbent will be challenged and therefore will be voted out of office, the newspapers, television, and radio simply have not been paying attention to these races. So without a race, the voters don't learn anything because they don't hear anything. And the media doesn't pay any attention because nothing is happening in the race.
Reed's assessment is borne out in an Annenberg School and University of Wisconsin analysis of the 2002 congressional races on local TV news in the nation's top 50 markets. It found that across the country, there was a paucity of news stories on these races, but at the same time, a major revenue windfall for the same stations, which made millions selling paid political ads during the same newscast. So for challenger Brozak, without a lot of money and spotty local media coverage, it means hitting the pavement every day, even a cold, dank one like this.
It's the only way that you can show people how sincere you are about getting the job done. You've got to go out there and meet them where they live.
Brozak wanted five debates, but he concedes he's happy he got one. Ferguson got TV ads in heavy rotation, while Brozak just managed to get a limited TV buy during the GOP convention in New York. That set him back $50,000. No news organizations are even polling the race.
How are you, Steve?
Good, good, real good, thanks.
In shiny black shoes and a black suit with a Marine Service lapel pin, the challenger looks like a Secret Service agent. He spots a group of parents and kids in a backyard swing set and makes a beeline with a flyer in hand.
And that insert is a little bit about me and my background. I served in the military and was one of the reservists, and also where I stand on the issues. This flyer shows that New Jersey is 41st in Homeland Defense funding and Wyoming is number one. Have you thought about the election yet, or you're still thinking about it?
I'm still thinking about the election, actually, right now. I haven't made my decision yet, and honestly, I haven't got any information about you, but now I do. So.
Right.
So better to make a more informed decision than just going down there and eeny, meeny, miny, moeing.
Great. Well, again, I appreciate it.
Brozak remains optimistic and soldiers on door to door as night falls. He says there are 20,000 freshly registered voters in the district. It's just going to take a lot longer getting to each one of them one by one, house by house. For On the Media, I'm Bob Henley.
When Afghans went to the polls last month, the world took notice. When Iraqis elect their representatives, possibly in June, the world certainly will pay attention. But when Americans pull the lever for their guy in a little over a week, the world is going to take that one personally. And no corner of the world more than America's chief ally in the Iraq War, Britain.
Last week, we noted that Britain's left-leaning Guardian newspaper had launched a letter-writing campaign to persuade registered independents in Clark County, Ohio, to vote for Kerry. Among the newly enlisted pen pals were some impressive names, including master spy novelist John le Carré.
Please don't feel isolated from the Europe you twice saved. Give us back the America we loved, and your friends will be waiting for you. And here in Britain, for as long as we have Tony Blair singing the same lies as George Bush, your nightmares will be ours.
And historian Antonia Fraser.
If you back Kerry, you'll be voting against a savage, militaristic foreign policy of preemptive killing, which has stained the great name of the US so hideously in recent times. I say the great name of the US because I believe that to be profoundly true. Almost every movement towards liberty having its roots or its refuge in the US.
And eminent science writer Richard Dawkins.
Don't be so ashamed of your president. The majority of you didn't vote for him. If Bush is finally elected properly, that would be the time for Americans abroad to start simulating a Canadian accent. Please don't let it come to that.
The Guardian reports that the American response was, well, shall we say, mixed, ranging from the grateful and gracious to the venomous and downright unreadable. Those with delicate sensibilities may want to turn down their radios for a minute. This came from Ohio.
I am a student and a lifelong resident of Clark County. I just wanted you to know that this is a wonderful idea you've initiated. People here love and respect the United Kingdom, especially the Prime Minister. I hope this campaign will be successful for your newspaper and for us voters.
And this came from Texas.
Real Americans aren't interested in your pansy-ass tea-sipping opinions. If you want to save the world, begin with your own worthless corner of it.
And this note was addressed simply from the U.S. of A.
Hey, England, Scotland, and Wales, mind your own business. We don't need weenie-spined limeys meddling in our presidential election. If it wasn't for America, you'd all be speaking German. But out.
We don't really mean that. It's just that your American cousins are a little cranky at the moment. By the way, the letters were real, but the voices weren't. Coming up, a poll on both your houses and the Sinclair Broadcasting Group's self-inflicted wounds.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This is poll season, and there's no vaccine. We've all been infected. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
You know, in a democracy, the people are the source of wisdom and ultimate power. And I would like my elected representative to poll all the time, trying to understand that wisdom of the people.
Yeah, well, that's Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, so he would say that. But there's no separating polling from politicking these days. So despite its hallowed place in the pantheon of pollsters, this year Gallup is being charged with a Republican bias, because it assumes that only 15% of voters will be non-white and 18% will be liberal. Both were a few percentage points higher in 2000, and we just don't know what the political and racial complexion of the electorate will be this time around.
The conflicting methodologies of various pollsters, from ABC to Zogby, have led to election forecasts that can be pretty much anything you want them to be. And the media, which carry the poll parasite like a swarm of tsetse flies, are the first to admit it.
4 years ago, roughly 2 weeks before Election Day, a CNN USA Today Gallup tracking poll of likely voters would continue to fluctuate, though usually showing Bush ahead, sometimes by as much as 13 points. But it was Gore who went on to win the popular vote.
But for those grown skeptical of those countless, conflicting, unreliable polls, CNN has engineered something altogether new for voters to contend with.
But our poll of polls, which averages major surveys, including our own, shows a tight race.
That's right, the poll of polls. CNN is hardly alone, though. The race to predict is breeding more polls, not less. Philip J. Traunstein, director of the Survey and Policy Research Institute at San Jose State University, wrote a primer on polling for the Los Angeles Times this week, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So how can so many news-gathering organizations with such faith in their own polling methods come up with such different results?
There are different methodologies involved, how they choose likely voters, question order, how questions are worded, and what order they take place in, and of course, when polling is done.
Take, for instance, two very different methodologies, that used by Zogby and that used by the Gallup polls. Tell me how they could lead to different results.
Zogby asks people what their party identification is, and if he comes out with 50% Democrats and 30% Republicans, he'll balance that survey, that is, by applying a weight so that he has the same proportion of Republicans and Democrats that there were in the 2000 election as measured by exit polls. Other pollsters, like Gallup, believe that party identification, that it's an attitude. They count on the randomness of their survey to give them a representative sample, and they don't try to balance. So they might wind up with 40% Republicans and 35% Democrats.
What do you think of the recent criticism of Gallup that it tends to underestimate the black electorate and also underestimate the liberal electorate, and therefore their polls are coming out far more strongly in favor of Bush than is actually the case?
Well, I think that's a criticism that's primarily leveled by people who are supporters of Kerry. The Gallup poll has a magnificent record. I think there's a question that can be raised about the methodology. They have a 7-point scale that they use, and people are considered likely voters if they score high enough on that scale. That includes questions like, did they vote in the last election? How closely are they following the race? Do they know where their polling place is? Some people argue that this understates lower-income blacks, younger people. Gallup would certainly argue that based on the historical record, their methodology has been extremely reliable.
Let's talk about the new and probably unresolvable crisis in polling, which is the cell phone. More and more Americans are using cell phones as their only phone, especially young people, and there really is currently no adequate way to poll this unrepresented group.
If you take a look at some of the states that are really in play this year, these are states with big university populations. And let me give you an example of what that might mean. I lectured in a class at San Jose State last week. Virtually everyone in the class is a registered voter because the professor is pushing them to be registered voters. 25% of the people, when I asked for a show of hands, do not have a landline. They have only a cell phone. Those people are not in any poll. At the same time, that group of people tends not to be voters in very big numbers.
Let's talk briefly about the margin of error. I see again and again on CNN, in newspapers, in blogs, they often suggest that if the candidates are more than 4 points apart, then the one who's ahead is actually beyond the margin of error. And we know that's not true. You really have to have an 8-point difference to overcome a 4-point margin of error.
You see a lot of stories where reporters say Bush is ahead 49-48. Those numbers don't mean much, except in the aggregate, except when you look at lots and lots and lots of polls, which show a 3- and 4-point lead, then you can pretty well guess that Bush has a slight lead.
If you have a public consuming these polls all the time, the public can get drawn up into the numbers, and as a result, they can become, in some cases, a self-fulfilling prophecy?
It's possible, but I don't think that's a terrible problem. We can assume that people are bright enough to be able to figure out that these are snapshots in time and are not necessarily guides to how they should act in the future.
But I guess you can forgive those of us in the public for hoping for a little schadenfreude when the headline Dewey Wins comes out based on the polls, and it isn't Dewey after all.
The cell phone issue and how pollsters have chosen their likely voters are the two pieces of the puzzle that make possible a Dewey beats Truman event. And I think there'd be plenty of people out there who would say, aha, boy, am I glad those pollsters messed it up.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Philip J. Traunstein is director of the Survey and Policy Research Institute at San Jose State University.
Soon, election polling will come to an end, and the public will once again be free to keep its opinions, smart or idiotic, to itself. Pollsters will likely use the quiet to recalibrate their polling methodology in preparation for the next poll that matters. But the Partnership for a Poll-Free America has watched this cycle before and isn't convinced that progress lies in creating a better poll. They want to get rid of polls altogether. The group was founded by comic Harry Shearer and syndicated columnist Arianna Huffington. She joins me now. Arianna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Allow me to be devil's advocate here because I myself am like a lunatic zealot on this subject. But, Arianna, what's so bad about polling?
Well, Bob, we are treating these polling results with the kind of reverence that ancient Romans gave to chicken entrails. And yet they are the product of polling about 30 to 35% of those actually called. They are the only ones who agreed to be polled. And I have a feeling that there may be a small and representative minority of bored and lonely Americans who have nothing better to do than talk to strangers for no money.
And who's giving the weight to opinions? Are politicians paying more attention to these, what you say, are skewed results than politicians should be?
It's actually both politicians and the media. I mean, look, Bob, it's unbelievable how every cable show is leading these days with the latest polling results, even though they're all over the map. And it's not like this doesn't have an impact. It has a huge impact on fundraising. It has a huge impact on morale. It has a huge impact on volunteers putting those extra hours helping their candidates.
You're suggesting that polls are probably inaccurate, that they're polling the wrong people and excluding some of the right people, and that too much weight is put on them. And your solution is what?
Well, my solution is born of reality. We are not going to end the addiction of politicians and the media to polls. The only thing we, the people, have control over is offering our opinion to the pollsters. That's why we started this campaign, and any of your listeners can join by going to arianaonline.com and taking the pledge that they will not talk to pollsters. They can talk to them socially, but they should hang up on them if they call them at home, interrupting their dinner and asking them questions about this or any other election. If we can bring the response rate down to single digits, then even pollsters will have to admit that their results are pretty meaningless.
In 2003, you ran for governor of California in the recall election, and you said that, quote, what we need are political leaders with the wisdom to see what does not show up in the polling data and the passion to work to create the consensus for it. I think you hit on a paradox in our democracy. People demand leadership, and yet they are offended when their leaders stray somehow from the consensus. Polls, of course, are all about consensus. What's the solution?
Well, the solution is bold leaders who are willing to appeal to what is best in us and create a new consensus. And it has happened. Going back to the Emancipation Proclamation, which Abraham Lincoln signed, even though it was a deeply unpopular document, right through to Bobby Kennedy's run for president, he appealed to people in what we now call red states and blue states by creating a new consensus around the moral imperative of fighting poverty and getting out of Vietnam. So it has happened before. It can happen again. Just hang up on pollsters.
All right. Well, my chicken entrails within a margin of error of 3% tell me that it's never going to happen.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, Arianna, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Arianna Huffington is a nationally syndicated columnist. In 2003, she ran for governor of California as an independent. The polls predicted she would lose, and they were right.
By the time you hear this, 40 local television stations, many of them in swing states, will have aired a politically incendiary primetime program about election season documentaries. Sinclair Broadcasting Group, the media conglomerate that owns the stations, described it as a news special. But others, including Sinclair's Washington bureau chief John Lieberman, called it, quote, blatant political propaganda, specifically of the anti-Kerry sort. I'm sorry, make that former Washington bureau chief. For those words, Lieberman was fired on Monday. Lieberman was referring to Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal, a short film that attacks Kerry's anti-war activism after he served in Vietnam. Sinclair originally ordered its stations to air that program, triggering a massive boycott campaign of Sinclair's advertisers and a precipitous dive in the value of Sinclair's stock. But on Tuesday, the company seemed to backtrack. It announced that actually only a few short segments from the film would be included in a report about the impact of political documentaries. Sinclair's stock shot back up, but not before several groups of shareholders threatened to sue the company for airing Stolen Honor without an opposing view, and that was followed by more lawsuits or threats of lawsuits for insider trading, libel, and copyright infringement. Blair Levin is a managing director at Legg Mason, a financial services company. He says the anti-Sinclair activists on the internet were triumphant at first.
A first kind of reaction was, great, we won. But now there was kind of a second wave of reaction saying, hey, wait a minute, they're actually just pretending that it's a real news show. But in fact, it's the same scurrilous smear of Senator Kerry just before the election. So one critical question that I would have for investors is, to what extent does this community feel, after seeing the actual event on Friday, that they should either declare victory or they should say, hey, wait a minute, anyone associated with this company, we should be boycotting?
The Columbia Journalism Review this week bestowed its first annual Ben Bagdikian Media Monopoly Award to Sinclair. The editorial said that the award goes to the person or company who, quote, has done the most to curb the dangerously rising power of media companies in America. Sinclair seems to fit the bill better than any opponent of media consolidation that CJR could come up with.
Yeah, Sinclair's business plan in some ways depends on the FCC granting certain kinds of relief for certain media ownership limits. They want to be able to buy more stations in the markets where they're currently operating. It's our view that by doing what they did, they've created a situation in which they're essentially a poster child for what the opponents of media concentration regard as the dangers of media concentration. That's going to make relief more difficult to achieve if John Kerry is elected. But the interesting thing is that under a Bush administration, it makes it much more politically difficult precisely because it will now look like a Sinclair payback.
So you would suggest then that it was a bad business maneuver either way for Sinclair?
Well, certainly if you look at it in the kind of sometimes narrow way in which I look at it, like, was this more likely to make the regulatory situation better for them or less likely? Clearly, it makes it less likely. Clearly, it's a bad business decision in that regard. And I would note, I don't think the company has ever defended their decision on the basis that it was a good business decision, which is actually kind of interesting.
Yeah, that seems to bring us to the crux of the matter. Is it possible that we shouldn't be trying to understand Sinclair in the way we have traditionally understood media conglomerates, or for that matter, corporations in general? NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen has argued that Sinclair isn't so much a commercial broadcaster with a political agenda as a political broadcaster with an expanding commercial base.
Well, certainly they have been much more upfront about their politics. Traditionally, media companies have been pretty middle of the road. And one of the reasons why the media ownership issue is so important to some folks is that this is the medium by which we are supposed to have civic discourse. And if this is a medium which is taken over by one side or the other, how will we ever get a fair and diverse debate?
Let's turn for a moment to Stolen Honor, the documentary slash partisan film slash news that Sinclair said was simply telling the facts. Now, anyone can download a copy of the script or even for a few dollars the documentary itself, in which POWs contend that Americans did not commit atrocities in Vietnam. Of course, last year's Pulitzer Prize-winning series in the Toledo Blade documents the testimony of several Vietnam vets that, in fact, they did participate in the murder of many, many civilians. Now, this has implications far beyond this election, I think.
Oh, absolutely. One of the very interesting things I think about this election is the way that the fragmentation of the media has led to people going to the media to have their own views confirmed. And there's an awful lot of kind of misinformation out there. Now, I think it's dangerous when we don't have folks who are doing the kind of fact-checking that traditionally the middle-of-the-road media has done, so as to give people some kind of sense of what actually is factually true and what is not, in fact, true.
We don't know the end of the story yet. The show has aired. Sinclair recovered a lot of its stock losses. The boycotts may or may not continue. The lawsuits may or may not be filed. But does the very fact that Sinclair tried something different and tried something that was scary to a lot of people, does that mean that the entire industry has approached a sort of Rubicon?
Well, I certainly think this will become something of a watershed moment. If nothing else happens and the advertiser boycotts go away and the lawsuits go away and the FCC does nothing, both on the fairness question but also on the ownership question, I would not be surprised to see other broadcasters use the broadcasting platform for partisan political purposes very directly and overtly in future elections. But I think that there's going to be a continuing question about the impact of this on media ownership issues. And I think it may cause some effort to have a renewal of the more traditional fairness doctrines or equal opportunity kinds of requirements that in the past have been clear. I wouldn't be surprised to see legislation that would deal with the kind of questions raised by what Sinclair did.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Blair Levin is a managing director of Legg Mason and served as chief of staff to former FCC chairman Reed Hunt. Coming up, newspaper endorsements. So much pain, so little impact. And campaign politics with a mouse.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There's more than a week left before the election, but many have voted already, including Americans abroad, shut-ins, and newspapers. As of Friday, 60 newspapers had endorsed John Kerry, 53 George Bush. One decidedly important undecided is in Ohio, that big swinging electoral bonanza of a state where some expect the Columbus Dispatch to shed 80 years of tradition and endorse the Democratic nominee. Joe Strupp, senior editor at Editor and Publisher magazine, has been tracking the endorsements and the high-profile non-endorsements as well.
We found that of the five top circulation papers, the New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and USA Today, only the New York Times and Washington Post endorsed for president. The LA Times used to. Their last endorsement was 1972 for Nixon, and there was a decision at the time by Otis Chandler, who had been publisher. In deference to his father, the previous publisher, he had kept the endorsements going but felt that the paper needed to sort of get away from its conservative roots and image and become more of a broad-based paper, and the decision was made not to endorse. He sort of threw the 72 endorsement to Nixon as a goodbye endorsement present. USA Today has never endorsed. Al Newharth, when he started the paper, had a long-standing doctrine that it would label the paper Democrat or Republican. And the Wall Street Journal, as Paul Jugot, the editorial page editor, told us, decided that its coverage of issues and its editorials on issues, it believes, give enough information so that an endorsement isn't necessary for president. So that's sort of an interesting factor I found.
If the paper has made the decision that they do want to print an endorsement, how does it work? What's the process?
Well, most papers have some size of editorial board, and they get together, discuss, some have votes, and then the majority, or at least the broader feeling, prevails. But in most cases, a publisher can have final say, although most of the editorial editors we talked to said publishers rarely put that veto power to use. The Seattle Times public editor wrote a couple columns talking about how they got into things, and that there was a real dispute between their editorial page editor and the publisher, the editorial page editor and the board wanting to endorse Kerry, the publisher vocally wanting to support Bush, and in the end, the paper supporting Kerry.
With these large editorial boards, is this process like the Supreme Court, in which someone in the majority opinion writes the opinion and those in the minority just kind of lick their wounds?
That is, I think, a good comparison. We took the Atlanta Journal-Constitution as sort of an example. Their process is that the publisher is not involved, that the six-member board votes, and the vote is clear. They ended up endorsing Kerry. And they said one of the editorial writers who supported Kerry in the vote wrote the endorsement.
What about dissenting opinions? Do they ever find their way into print?
A handful of papers, if not more, often write an editorial not opposing the endorsement but sort of giving the other side. Or in more cases, a columnist or editorial writer might get space on the op-ed page to say, well, here's the other opinion. But I think in general you don't have the opposing view given equal weight. That's why the endorsement is what it is.
Historically, there have been some incidents where publishers have not only intervened in the process, but done it in a fairly extravagant way.
Offhand, I don't recall that element, but there have been some other interesting ones. One I came across was Newsday in 1960. The publisher and the editor were married to each other. Harry Guggenheim and Alicia Patterson was the editor. Guggenheim was the publisher. And she had come out strongly for John Kennedy and run an editorial endorsing him. He was so strongly in favor of Nixon that he convinced her to allow him to write a column that appeared on the opposite page praising Nixon. And some of the folk at Newsday I've talked to and things I've read claim that almost led to divorce.
Hmm. Wow. A Nixon endorsement. I guess I'll stop complaining about my wife's library finds. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joe Strupp is senior editor at Editor and Publisher magazine, which to date hasn't endorsed anybody.
As we've heard, newspapers' presidential endorsements are serious undertakings, often decided after passionate, even rancorous debate. So when they're printed, politicians quake, readers gasp, and the political earth stands still. Or not so much.
Stop the presses! The Tampa Tribune, that bulwark of Florida conservatism, has given George Bush the Barry Goldwater treatment, making him only the second Republican presidential candidate not to get the paper's endorsement in 52 years. No, really, stop the presses, or don't even bother turning them on, because this wrenching decision, described with palpable anguish in the Tribune's lead editorial Tuesday, is likely to have no impact on the election whatsoever. Nor will the New York Times endorsement of John Kerry, nor whatever the Columbus Dispatch decides to do. Why? Well, there are three reasons. Number one is that newspaper editorial endorsements tend to be printed in the editorial pages of newspapers, where at least 80% of the American electorate seldom looks.
The crossword puzzle, for God's sake, does better.
Mary Ann Lindley is editorial page editor of the Tallahassee Democrat, which is less doctrinaire than its Tampa counterpart, but faces the same readership reality, which is that only half of adult Americans read weekday newspapers, compared to more than 80% in 1964, and only a fraction of them regularly turn to the opinion pages. Least of all, the undecideds, who pretty much by definition are disengaged, disaffected, terribly confused, or possibly actually comatose. Paul Maslin is a Democratic political consultant.
They are the last people you're going to find reading newspapers or reading a newspaper editorial. We're lucky if they're going to watch television news or listen to the radio.
Not that the rest of the electorate is hanging on the local editorial board's every word. Individual papers tend to keep this information proprietary, but unofficially report frequent opinion page readership ranging from 25 to 30% of subscribers, or, as that level of interest is often phrased, about the same as the sports pages. Whether we should be heartened that we as a nation are equally interested in the issues of the day and the plays of the day is one question. Another question might be, as much readership as the sports pages? Oh, really?
Nobody wants to admit they haven't read the editorial page.
Linnell Burkett is editorial page editor of the San Antonio Express News and president of the National Conference of Editorial Writers.
I know there are some people who say that numbers might appear a little bit inflated because people say, oh, yes, I read the editorial page.
Whatever the actual readership, and here's problem number two, Americans' reaction to opinion leaders isn't particularly compliant. Some few people do use editorials and opinion pieces to know what to think. Others, let's say me, use them to learn more about issues, to understand the arguments, and to help think things through. Still others, apparently the vast majority, use them like that little button on your gas grill. Press here to start the flames. Linnell Burkett.
The nation is surly right now. They're unhappy. They're polarized.
Most of the electorate are dug in on one side or the other, and those who are persuadable are really a fairly tiny minority.
Don Wycliffe, public editor of the Chicago Tribune and 15-year veteran of the editorial page, spends his day engaging readers who not only don't appreciate being enlightened, but are deeply suspicious of the motives of those doing the enlightening. Editorialists will spend hours or days chewing over an issue only to be dismissed as biased, corrupt, or dictated to by a cigar-chomping publisher with a sinister agenda. Or as Gail Collins, editorial page editor of the New York Times, so elegantly phrases it,
most people are happiest reading things that reinforce opinions that they already have.
She knows this because when confronted with contrary opinions, those readers rush to their computers to inform the authors what morons and fools they are, which for conscientious journalists can be dispiriting.
If you spent your entire day reading emails, you probably would want to shoot yourself.
But no, the ranks of the professionally opinionated soldier on, trying at least to frame the debate on issues large and small. The Chicago Tribune's Don Wycliffe says it's not just a question of talking readers into a position, but to incrementally advance understanding of complicated questions and to offer a rare commodity, a philosophy of examining issues based not on knee-jerk partisanship or showbiz pyrotechnics, but on research and rigorous contemplation.
We may write an editorial today about some aspect of the Chicago public school system, and, you know, people will not run to the barricades because of it, but over time, along with other editorials, it may cause some lights to go on and people to say, hey, you know, the Tribune has been giving us more wisdom on this than anybody else. Let's listen to what they have to say.
Lo and behold, every now and then, people do listen. The Des Moines Register's endorsement of Dark Horse John Edwards in this spring's Iowa caucuses helped propel him to a second-place finish and a spot on the Democratic ticket. And though that effect is rare in presidential politics, it's commonplace elsewhere. The Washington Post's endorsement is widely credited with electing Mayor Marion Barry in 1978, and such direct influence increases as you move down the ballot, where Sean Hannity and Paul Begala have neglected to cloud your mind. The New York Times endorsements extend all the way down to civil court. Burkett's San Antonio paper vets the candidates for state and local office and asks people to take its endorsements into the voting booth. Readers of the Tallahassee Democrat evidently do just that. Marianne Lindley, who the rest of the year plays second fiddle to the crossword, can quantify the overlap between her page's picks and the outcomes of legislative races, referenda, school board seats, and so on.
We have about an 80% success rate in our endorsements. Now, some people will say, well, you're just in touch with your readers, but I think we are in touch with our community.
Which is exactly why, like its cross-state rival, the Tribune, it will not be endorsing anyone for president.
Really, I just think it wouldn't make any difference. I don't think the local newspaper would change one mind. If we did, I would be just stunned.
In other words, let sleeping dogs lie. But there's yet a reason number three that newspapers' presidential endorsements are of negligible importance. A 1996 study by the Annenberg Public Policy Center asked presidential voters if they were influenced by newspaper endorsements. Only 11% said yes, and of them, 25%, when asked who the endorsement endorsed, got the answer wrong.
Say that you are, like many in our audience, a political junkie. You're watching the debate and you hear the president say for the 11th time that running the White House is hard work, and you think, he shouldn't do that. Then you hear John Kerry invoke the phrase global test and you say, that was a gift to the GOP. Come on, you think, with a degree of self-confidence entirely unjustified by your level of experience. I could do better than that. Well, with the development of new Sims-like run-your-own-campaign video games, you get the chance to try. Clive Thompson has played them and lived to tell the tale in Slate. Clive, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks.
Now, I played the easiest of the games. This is the one you can play for free online. It's called Elections. And you select five topics to campaign on, and then you spin for your turn. And you hop down a game board. You describe it in your article as a goofy kind of candy land. Now, I won by a landslide. It was just too easy.
Yeah, I found that game really easy. One of the ones that I found almost too hard was the one called President Forever, because in that case, you've got this map. It takes 22 different issues from taxes to Social Security to the war, and it shows you exactly how you're rated in all those 22 issues in every single state, which is great. But what you discover is that it's really hard to manage that much information.
And you totally blew it.
Oh,
right?
I completely blew it. Yeah, yeah. I played as Carrie, and I lost every single state except for Maine and Washington. It really made me reappreciate how hard it is to be a campaign manager, someone who really just has this memory for what every county is trending.
Now, one of the games that you mentioned allows you to actually play earlier campaigns, Kennedy versus Nixon or Bush 1 versus Clinton, and it also allows you some fantasy tickets.
Yeah, sure. If you wanted to, you could actually create your own candidate. You could pair people up in really weird ways. You could take like Schwarzenegger and have him campaign with Hillary Clinton just to see what would happen. In that case, there are people who will throw themselves really, really extreme challenges, like set themselves up with a sitting president and they'll make the economy in fantastic shape. And there'll be almost no, you know, international unrest. And trying to unseat a president in that situation is really, really hard, as you find out.
Now, would you consider yourself more of a gamer or more of a political wonk, or the perfect combination of the two for which these games were designed?
Oh, I think I'm probably more of a gamer. I got a little swept up in sort of being fascinated by, ooh, I could, you know, I change all these different things and, you know, look at the little graphics of planes going across.
On the other hand, though, it was the political wonk inside of you, Clive, that seemed to feel that there was a missing piece in the game, and that was the power of language.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the one thing about these games that seems a little unrealistic is that you can sort of get into these fake mock TV debates and interviews with people like Bill O'Reilly. He'll ask you a question and you have a couple of, you know, answers you can choose from, like a choose your own adventure. That isn't very realistic because this campaign is turning on tiny phrasings on TV, a single word. So I think that that was kind of unrealistic. Although, as a friend of mine pointed out, when I complained about this, he said, what is unrealistic about someone on the campaign stump only having four different phrases they can say?
And the media do seem to play an enormous part in many of these games. Newspaper endorsements, polls, advertising, smear tactics.
On the game President Forever, a headline would flash up. I was playing as Kerry. It's like, Bush smears you on your Vietnam record. And you would have this little button next to it called spin. You had a certain amount of political energy to use every round. You can use that flying somewhere or campaigning, but you can use it spinning. So if a really bad headline came out, I would just be frantically clicking the spin button, trying to, like, you know, blunt the damage. And another, I think, sort of funny thing was the use of smear merchants in Political Machine. I got completely greased the first few times I tried it. I realized that what you need to do is hire a bunch of smear merchants and send them into certain battleground states. And I did a lot better after that. There's some kind of fun political satire, too, because there's this Michael Moore-like propagandist director who, if he shows up in the state, can really help you. And there's a media darling who, I guess, is someone like, you know, Ben Affleck. And then there's a kook, someone who, like, is really into your cause, but because he's so insane, you're not sure whether he's going to help or hurt you.
So he's a LaRoucheite.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. When he shows up in Ohio, you know, you're just, it's a flip of the coin.
You know, Clive, the first time we talked was a couple of years ago, and you had written a story about the evolution of video games that actually function as sort of political messages, an interactive commercial, so to speak. Are any of these like that? Are they trying to send a political message, or is the message simply one of cynicism about the political process?
I don't think these games were made to tell a particular political agenda. They seem pretty neutral that way. But they do have a political message. You really get a visceral, almost sensual appreciation of why these battleground states are, you know, so captivating the imaginations of the candidates, why the rest of the country is getting ignored. It actually made someone like me come out thinking, wow, you know, maybe we should reform the Electoral College, you know, which people are talking about, because it so changes the way you play the game. So in that sense, I think there may be a message that comes out of it of understanding how the political system works better and better.
Yeah, but you're a Canadian.
I'm a Canadian. I think we should have a prime minister. You know, what can I say?
Clive, thank you very much.
Take care.
Clive Thompson wrote Sim Shrum for Slate. If you go to onthemedia.org, we'll link you to his story, and from there you'll be linked to the games. His blog is called collisiondetection.net.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.